Hi, this is Betsy at the Legislative Information Office, ready for a sound check.
Okay, how does this one sound? Check.
That sounds good.
And check, check, check.
That sounds good.
Check, check, check.
That one's a little bit quieter. You may want to turn it up a bit.
How's that? Is that better?
Yeah, that's much better.
And check, check, check.
That sounds good.
Check, check, check.
That sounds good.
Check, check, check.
Sounds good.
Check, check, check.
That sounds good. Sounds good. Sounds good.
Check, check, check.
That sounds good. Kathleen, you said that was the last one, right?
Yeah, that was the last one. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Have a good meeting.
How about now? Can you hear me? Louder? Okay. How about there? Woo. Is that good or too loud? Okay. Thanks.
Resources Committee to order. Today's Friday, February 14th. Let the record reflect that it is 3:33 p.m. Committee members present today, Senator Bishop, Senator Machicki, Senator McGuire, Senator French, and myself, Senator Giesel. Excused absences, Senator Fairclough and Vice Chair Dyson. Recording secretary today is Nancy Jones, and Kathleen Nyson is helping us on the LIO, as well as my trustee staff, Lindsay Williams. So today we're going to hear from our consultants, Nico Safus and Jenik Mayer from Analytica. So they're going to go through a presentation. After that, we're going to take up SJR 5, offshore oil and gas revenues. So welcome, Mr. Safus and Mr. Mayer. I'll let you begin your presentation.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Jenik Mayer, a partner in Analytica. I'm a little out of breath from the
I
dead.
I know, yes.
It's now my third year up here working with the Alaska Legislature on oil and gas issues. Previously, of course, for the last 2 years working on oil tax reform issues, and then transitioning over the course of this last year to working on gas issues through the gas symposium that we put on in Anchorage last year. For the last 6 years or so, I led the analytics team at PFC Energy, focused on upstream economic and financial evaluation, constructing economic and financial models of projects, assets, transactions, portfolios for everything from large international companies to national oil companies to small independent players to private equity firms. And that focus on modeling and evaluation and fiscal terms analysis is in the core to my expertise. With that, I will hand over to my colleague, Nikos.
Thank you, Jack. For the record, Nikos Safos, partner in Analytica. My background, similar to Jenik, I spent the last 7.5 years at a company called PSC Energy, a consulting firm focused in oil and gas. My chief responsibility by the end of this was heading the global gas consulting practice of the firm. And so in that capacity, I have worked with some of the world's largest oil and gas companies on a number of themes, but critically the three things that I focused most of my time on was helping companies that have gas figure out how to sell it, companies that want gas figure out how to buy it, and then companies trying to make sense of what's happening in the market, in markets, and helping them think through possibilities and scenarios. And so my core expertise is natural gas markets, and commercialization strategies. With that, we wanted to talk today about several key ideas, but we wanted to really zoom in on alignment. It's a word that gets thrown out a lot. Everyone agrees how great it is and how important it is. And so we wanted to think through that word a little bit and to give you a sense of where we're at. The last time we were here, we talked to you about sort of where we were in the project development and how many things were getting bolted down. And we also talked to you about the MOU and TransCanada. And so we wanted to step back a little bit and perhaps ask and answer some more existential questions about what this thing looks like and why is SB 138 in front of you, in effect. Why have you come to the decision point that you have today? Okay. And in the conversations that we've had with a number of people here in Juneau, we've also come to appreciate that more and more people appreciate just how complicated gas is and how complicated LNG is and how different it is from oil. So we wanted to figure out a way to present LNG as if it were oil, to sort of tap into the fact that most people, both in the legislature as well as, you know, Alaskans that are watching this, they understand they have dealt with oil for a very long time. So this is our effort to do this. So bear with us. We'll walk through about 4 or 5 slides, and then we'll get to what this really means for you. And so slide number 4 begins with the Department of Revenue Sources book, the fall 2013 edition, page 106, as per the footnote. And there's nothing fancy here. We've just copied and thrown that in there. We haven't really done anything to it. We just copied it. And we've shown fiscal year 2015 purely because that's a year where SB21 sort of applies to all the production. So don't read too much into that. So what does this chart really tell us? It tells us that the Department of Revenue has a forecast of oil at about $105. It then says that there's about $10 that go away in the midstream, some for marine transportation, shipping, some in the TAPS tariff, and then there's another category called other, quality balancing. It doesn't really matter. The point is you start from $105 oil and you take out $20 for the midstream. Then there are lease expenditures, about $46 in this chart. And so you end up with a barrel up in the slope or at the wellhead that's worth about $49, right? So this is what the oil value chain look like, and this is what you've been accustomed to looking at. You say, well, what's the price of ANS? You ask what's the TAPS tariff, and sometimes you argue about what the TAPS tariff should be, and then you talk about expenditures, and then you end up with the barrel at the slope that you tax. And so how does this picture differ if we were to think about oil? Let's go to slide 5. Well, the first thing that's different is that the price of gas isn't quite as clear as the price of oil. So it's less transparent. We've talked to you about this in a number of times that you can't really pick up the Wall Street Journal, and this is no fault of the Wall Street Journal, to pick up and say, what's the price of LNG? It doesn't really work that way. It's a much more opaque market, a lot more over-the-counter, a lot more driven by specific deals rather than a posted price out there that you can look at. It's less consistent. We've shown you some examples, and we'll show you some more today, that really that's very variable by destination and, in fact, variable by contract, that the same project could be selling gas to 5 different people for 5 very different prices. So it's not the same way as oil where you pick up and you say what the price of oil is. If you ask what the price of gas is, the answer you get is not a 3-second answer. It's a much more complicated answer. It's likely going to be linked to oil, the price of gas that you will sell. And it's likely going to be linked to this thing called JCC, which is colloquially the Japan Crude Cocktail, but officially stands for the Japan Customs Cleared Price. And the reason I say this is to tell you that you don't have to worry about it. It's effectively the price that Japan pays for its oil. Mm-hmm. And we did an analysis back to 2004 to 2013. It basically trades at a 22-cent discount to ANS. So for all intents and purposes, if you sell LNG that is linked to JCC, you might as well just say it's linked to ANS. You don't have to worry about JCC. And the last thing is, in general, oil trades at a thermal discount to gas. So if you have 100...
Just a point of order. Isn't it the other way around?
Yes, Senator French, a question?
So, did I say oil?
Yeah.
Discuss? My apologies.
Okay. I just want you to know we're paying attention.
It was actually a test. No.
I was always horrible about that. Just throw my hand up.
No, it's very good. And this is definitely not one we want to get wrong, because that will create some expectations that will be hard to play out. So gas trades at a discount to oil. So a $100 barrel does not lead you to $100 of barrel of oil equivalent of LNG. There are a number of reasons for that. The chief one of them is that especially in the market that you're targeting, which is Asia, there are still consumers where if the price of LNG were higher than the price of oil, they would try to the extent possible to switch from LNG to oil. So when sometimes in the marketplace when you're looking for individual cargoes, the price of that cargo gets too expensive. We've seen consumers say, I'd rather not buy that cargo because oil is cheaper. So in some ways, oil places a little bit of a cap to the price of gas.
Senator Machicki?
I think it's important because last year we also heard this. Could you please explain for folks that may be watching BOE so that people don't think you're putting 42 gallons of LNG in a barrel and selling it?
Sure. Through the chair, Nico Stafos for the record. BOE is essentially a barrel of oil equivalent. That's what it stands for. And it tries to get to the question of how much energy do different sources, do different fuel agents have, so oil, gas, coal. And so this effectively trying to turn gas into having the same energy as oil. And so you go through a conversion process. We'll go through that conversion process. But essentially, in theory, a barrel and a barrel of oil equivalent should generate the same amount of energy or contain the same amount of energy. Okay. That's the idea. Thank you for that clarification. So top line, price, less transparent, less consistent, likely linked to oil, but also lower value than oil. Now let's go to the second part, slide six, the midstream. Now the midstream, we know it's going to be more expensive. We know that because we know that gas is more expensive to transport than oil. We know that the tariff is not going to regulate it by, not going to be regulated by FERC. And we also know that the tariff is going to be very much driven by not just the cost, but also the capital structure, how you structure the expected return on this investment. And I think you have enough experience with arguments over TAPS to understand just how contentious that could be. So this is these are the two main differences that we would like to highlight. And having said that, let me go to the next slide, slide seven, and say, okay, let's take this graph and make it into LNG. So let's start at the beginning. So the top line, now we're talking about an LNG price that is in barrel of oil equivalent. And we say that at $100 oil, the oil equivalent is going to be only 81. Now, don't take this as a forecast. Take this as a reasonable number of what that discount may be. Right? So none of these numbers are meant to focus on, oh, why is that 24.18? It's meant to really step back and think generally about what this thing looks like and why is alignment important and why are we talking about alignment. So that's the purpose. The purpose is not to go through each one of these numbers. The second thing I'd like to point out to you is that 384. So this is actually effectively about 400,000 barrels of oil equivalent of exported gas. So that's a big chunk of energy. If I go back one slide to slide six, the forecast for FY 2015 is almost 500,000 barrels of oil. So this at almost 400, this is a huge amount of energy. Now let's go to one step down, midstream, $66 per barrel of oil equivalent. So remember oil, 10, this, 66. Upstream, about 6. We've taken a fairly conservative assumption. These numbers are not dissimilar to what you're hearing from the administration and their consultants. And so if you go through that math, and again, don't read too much into that specific numbers, you end up with about $9 a barrel of oil equivalent at the wellhead. And so when you look at that, you can say, well, let's tax that. But if the only thing you're really doing is trying to tax that, you're kind of ignoring the biggest part of the barrel, right, or the equivalent barrel, right? So 35% of a small number is a small number, and 50% of a small number is a small number, and 75% of a small number is a small number. And so that's really what we're trying to get at here. Let's go to slide eight and say, actually, if you do that math, again, nothing particularly complicated, it only takes a drop of ANS to almost $90 to take that $9 barrel and wipe it out. And at that point, you basically have no value up on the slope of tax. So now you're taking 35% of zero. So you're not really getting anything. Or in a different way, slide nine, and again, all we're changing are the things that have arrows to them. What if costs end up being 12% higher, or costs or tariffs? And again, not a particularly extreme assumption. And again, you end up with a zero. And this is in a $100 oil world. So the bottom line is when you look at this, and this is slide 10 that sort of brings it all together. When you look at this, you come up with a number of conclusions. And again, remember, the whole point of this is to talk about alignment and big picture. Big picture is you want to get a fair value for your gas. you want to get that 81. In fact, you like to get 85 or 90 or 95 if you can. That's a huge driver of value, because the better value you get for your gas, the more value there is. But the second thing that comes out really is midstream, midstream, midstream. That is such a huge part of the chain. And so how you think about that, how you structure that, whether you participate in that, is a huge driver for how this thing looks like. Now, I wouldn't try to forecast this, but if you think about the amount of pain and litigation that has gone through arguing over $10 a barrel on the oil midstream, take that and imagine what it would be if you're arguing over $66 of midstream. Right? It's just such a much bigger pie. Upstream is important, but in the grand scheme of things, it really pales in comparison to the midstream. And the last part is, wellhead is sort of insufficient. It's not really very big, right? And on the right, you can see the multiplication. 35% of 882 of 384,000 barrels a day is $370 million, right? Now, obviously, that's not the entire state take. The point is, it's not a very big number, especially when you go up and you look at what it looks like for oil, right? And obviously, there's credits here. There's more things going on. We're just trying to show you an order of magnitude, that you're producing 400,000 barrels versus 500,000 barrels, but at the end of the day, in this case, you end up with total tax before credits of $2.7 billion. In the other one, you end up with $370 million, right? So you're talking about a huge order of magnitude difference. And having said that, then I'll turn over to my colleague, Janik, and so he can take that analysis and put it in the context specifically of Alaska LNG.
So if we take that analysis and sort of look at something similar graphically in terms of split of value of a barrel of oil equivalent production in LNG at a range of different prices. In this chart, the prices on the bottom axis, and I should note there is an error in the labeling of the first bar, which I apologize, that should be $110 per barrel of oil equivalent, not $120. But if we take this and look at it as stepping across a range of $10 increments in per barrel of oil equivalent pricing. And so, for instance, that $80 barrel of oil equivalent, as Nicholas pointed out on the previous slides, could be roughly what you might expect as a sale price into Asia in a $100 ANS West Coast world. What that previous analysis shows and what this shows is that returns to the upstream and returns in terms of royalty and in terms of production tax vary wildly if those are the principal sources of revenue from this gas for the state of Alaska. They vary wildly with changes in price or alternatively with changes in cost. Here we show it in a price context, but you could do the same analysis on a cost basis. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me this is an interesting and in some ways counterintuitive point, because we've been talking about this in terms of royalty and tax in value versus taken in kind and a state share of gas with a corresponding idea of equity participation at that level throughout the different components. And when you think about that, the first thing you think of is, okay, I can see what the potential benefits from equity participation and all the rest and taking my share in gas could be. But intuitively, it seems like that should give me a lot of exposure to global gas prices and whether they're up or whether they're down. Am I really up for that exposure? And so counterintuitively, what this shows in that sense is not only that whatever the state does, it's exposed to risk from commodity prices, but that actually, in many ways, pure royalty and tax in value actually pose the greatest price risk to the state of Alaska because of this amplifying mechanism. So the reason for that...
Just maybe when you finish your thought, I'll ask a question. Thank you.
And the reason for that is precisely the construct of this fixed tariff. And it's, as we say, in the oil world, it's relatively a very small portion of the overall barrel of oil equivalent. It's such a big portion in this world that, you know, it's like looking at the rest of the midstream portion and saying, well, whatever the price is, you're guaranteed a particular rate of return,
and we're going to take what's left over or a share of what's left over. And if that fixed portion takes up the vast majority of the barrel of oil equivalent, what you have left varies wildly with very small changes in price. So a 10% drop in price can mean the difference between still a substantial revenue and tax take versus none at all. And value can very quickly be eroded. So in that sense, counterintuitively, taking value at the wellhead by netting it back actually increases your exposure to price risk in some ways.
Senator French, you had a question.
I do about this slide, and maybe I'm missing the point entirely, but a royalty in value should be fixed if we assume that our royalties are 12.5%. That's what the royalty slice is. And so I would expect to see that blue box be steady all the way down, but instead you have it shrinking. So I'm clearly missing the point of the slide. You'll have to explain it again.
Senator French, for the chair, the point is in that sense that it's a fixed proportion of a barrel of value at the wellhead on the North Slope.
As the barrel price decreases, the 12% decreases. Is that why I see just a tiny sliver?
Because it's not 12% of $100 or $110 in value.
Mm-hmm.
It's 12% of $100 or $110 in value minus
the tariff.
The tariff.
I see. Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Go ahead and proceed.
So that's the reason why when we talk about alignment, mm-hmm. there's the question of what that tariff is becomes critical, because small changes in capital structure, in rates of return, et cetera, that set that tariff can suddenly take away vast amounts of the share of value for the state.
Mm-hmm.
And also price movements can quickly see the value to the state disappear entirely.
Interesting.
We move on to the next slide. So the corresponding, and again, I say counterintuitive point in many ways, is that in lots of ways, gas, both royalty and tax, taken in kind with a corresponding equity share, in many regards actually offers more rather than less downside protection for the state. And counterintuitively, the state in this environment actually takes a little less on the upside. There is actually potentially more upside to the state in high-price environments from the in-value proposition, but more downside as well. And in the in-kind world, actually flattens out the curve and means that the state is a little less exposed on the downside and a little more, takes a little less when times are good as well. So what you see here on the screen are three charts that are some very preliminary results, not like the previous analysis, which were just a sort of stylized single barrel of production, but actual results from the model that we've built of an Alaska LNG project. You can see we've kept things fairly general at this point. We said talk about low, mid, high prices rather than specific price points, and that's in part because it's a model we've recently completed and are working with. We need to spend more time with the administration, with their consultants, talking to producers, et cetera, to refine some of the assumptions in the model, and so particular points will move around a bit as we go through that process. But the overall direction of analysis that this shows will stay the same, which is the question of, at in terms of relative price movements, where is value to the state in high prices and at low prices? And what this shows is that in a world in which the state takes and the HOA sort of sets out a range between 20 to 25% share of gas and corresponding equity stake throughout the value chain, in a world, and this isn't specifically addressing the question of the MOU and what the state chooses to do with that share at this point in the pipeline, just looking at that question of in value or in kind. Mm-hmm. In a world in which the state takes a 25% share of the gas and a corresponding 25% equity stake throughout gas treatment, pipeline, liquefaction. On the left-hand axis of each of these, we have total undiscounted cash flows and billions of dollars across a 30-odd year time frame, both for each chart in terms of for the state of Alaska on the left-hand chart, for producers on the central chart, and for the federal government on the right-hand chart. And so what you can see is, as I say, in fact, the return on this undiscounted basis is greatest for the in-kind world when prices are low, but in return for that, the state actually gives up a little when prices are high.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator French.
From the middle graph, looking at the chart for the producers, why is the crossover point at a different price than it is for the state?
Senator French, through the chair.
I mean, I would think it would be more or less the mirror image, that if I'm getting more in value at a certain price, they'd be getting less, and at some point it would cross over, and that I start losing and they start winning.
Senator French, to the chair, the short answer to that is that there are other stakeholders involved in this. The principal one that's shown here is the federal government, and the question of what their share and how their share changes over price levels also impacts that equation. And then, technically speaking, there's actually a fourth stakeholder that isn't shown here because what they receive doesn't really change based on price, because that's debt holders in the project.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are more variables at play rather than just what the state receives versus what the producer receives.
And just to follow up there, thank you, Madam Chair. TransCanada, I take it, performs identically to the state in this scenario?
Senator French, to the chair, it's an excellent question, and the answer is not necessarily. We haven't done a detailed analysis of the TransCanada participation as to what this means, but if you think it through it intuitively from the previous slide and the question of what that big 60% fixed wedge does to the price volatility, by involving a separate third-party midstream player in the midstream component, either for all of the state's share of the project or for 60% of the state's share of the project, it's important to understand that you are inherently, in doing that, bringing back into the equation some fixed tariff component. It's not the full $66. It's just the tariff on the look factor and the pipeline, and if the state were to exercise its 40% option, the level under which it's subject to that sort of fixed obligation is reduced further still. But it is reintroducing that fixed component, which then brings you somewhere between these two cases.
And Nikos Tasfordakis, if I could add to that, one of the reasons why this is not identical is because the state of Alaska's share includes parts of the chain that TransCanada is not a partner.
LNG.
Mm-hmm. LNG and the upstream. But the other thing is, if you go to this slide 11, the whole point of TransCanada is that they're operating in that red part, which is not necessarily price sensitive. Right? So they're getting a rate of return that's driven by the cost of the investment, the debt, the equity, the return on the debt, and the return on the equity, not the ultimate price of the LNG. So there, you would expect that their world is more price insensitive than state of Alaska's world.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good.
So we note that, and there's another important caveat to this analysis, which is very important to understand, which is one of the assumptions here, and again, we'll be doing further iterations of this as we work through the process, is that all parties, the producers and the state of Alaska, sell their LNG to the same price. If we were to do this analysis and say there's a substantial discount to the price the state of Alaska can get for its LNG versus the price, for instance, that producers can get, you start to see some different results. So this is simply trying to understand, all other things being equal, in-kind participation versus in-value participation. What does this mean for price risk for the state in either direction? So you have the state of Alaska being more insulated to some extent from price movements, taking less of the downside with less upside exposure, and the producers, as the counterpart, or at least as part of the counterpart to that, having greater price exposure through the in-kind world than they have through the in-value world. Also, though, the federal government in this has more exposure in the in-value world to price changes than in the in-kind world. So part of what happens through in-kind participation is by participating in the project, the state of Alaska is bringing itself in as a essentially non-taxpaying entity, assuming everything is structured as it needs to be to ensure that status, both not as a federal taxpayer and as an entity that, if it owes any state taxes, it owes them to itself. So we can largely discount those. Now, you could single out property taxes as something that don't go exclusively to the state of Alaska, but also go to municipalities. Here, we aren't factoring in property tax. We are, for the state of Alaska, we are considering property tax as a state obligation, whether one considers it to go to the state government itself or to municipalities. And so really what one has in the project are sort of two separate components, a producer component with revenues from the sale of LNG, costs associated with building the upstream, the different midstream components, tax obligations, and then netting those all out and after-tax cash flow. On the state of Alaska's side, we have the same revenues. We have the same cost components, or at least a 25% share of them, except for the upstream cost, which the state doesn't bear. And then we don't have the tax obligations. And so introducing that into the mix means that, in particular, when the state is taking relatively more as a share of the overall, and we'll see what this means in percentage terms on the next slide, but you can see even here, if relatively speaking the state is better off, in particular in lower price environments, that also means that as the non-taxpaying entity, the federal government is worse off in those low price environments, and that's the reason that you see that difference there. If we move to the next page, we've looked at those same cash flows coming out of the model in those same scenarios, but instead looked at them as shares of the overall net present value of the project. And so there are a couple of things to take away from this slide. The first, to me, is that, you know, when you think about 25% share in a project, 25% of the gas, 25% of the equity throughout the value chain, you think, okay, so the state is getting 25% of the overall value. And, you know, is that a reasonable deal? Is that good or is that bad? And the first thing to point out in that sense is actually it doesn't mean that the state is taking 25% of the value. In most circumstances, the state is actually taking substantially more than 25% of the value. And there are a couple of reasons for that, which come back to what I was saying largely with regard to the federal government. One, while the state foots 25% of the bill for the midstream components, it doesn't foot any of the bill for the upstream. And two, it's a tax-exempt player in this project. And so the portion of the value that it gets out of its 25% is very different to the portion of the value that the other 75% get from their taxed portion. Finally, you could actually show an even bigger difference if you ran this with a substantially different cost of capital for the state versus the producers and assumed a lower cost of capital for the state. Here we've actually run this at the same cost of capital for both to give a sense just really of what that difference in federal take largely does to state value. But what you can see again is that in particular, as prices go lower, and there are a number of reasons for this, including, for instance, the fact that property tax as an obligation on the producers is a fixed amount based not on their revenues, not on prices, but just on the capital value of their the physical infrastructure that they have. Things like that take up an ever larger portion of the total pie that the state is not paying. And so overall, the state is taking more and more of the value of the total net present value of the cash flows over time in low-price environments than in high-price environments. And there are times when that share is actually quite substantial, and not only much more than the 25%, but even a majority of the value that the project creates.
Senator French.
Just a simple question. On the y-axis, what do the percentages indicate?
They indicate the share of the total available net present value of the project between available to any one given stakeholder.
And I was afraid you were going to say that, but now I look at the low-price scenario as between the state, the producers, and the federal government, and I see it, the first place where I see a line under the low price is at about 60% for the state, 50% for the producers, and 15% for the federal government. And I don't see how that can possibly be right.
Senator French, I think you are absolutely spot on in that, and I would request your forbearance if I could to go back and check the numbers and submit a revised version of the slide if there's an error there.
Well, it looks like 125% to me. And you're nodding your head like, yeah, something's wrong. Okay.
I would like to check the numbers if I could.
Okay, good. I feel much better. I was feeling a little lost, and I don't feel as lost, but thanks.
And to the Chair Nikostopoulos, that's the only number. Everything else does add up to 100%. So that's the one that looks off. So
right at the beginning. Okay.
We'll make sure. Yeah, it's the one that stands out.
If I go to, like, the mid-price, I see 40. Yeah, maybe 40 and 20. Okay, I see. Yeah, okay. All right, so fair enough. Okay, is the starting point. Something's off there. Okay. But the mid-price, it looks okay. Fair enough.
Yes, Senator Bishop has a question.
Before we move off of that slide, just for, I want to go back to a comment. You know, you said, you know, with states 25% equity position, actually our value could become higher than the 25%, and that's because of our tax-exempt status from the feds, correct?
Senator Bishop, to the Chair, that's correct. There are other drivers, including the fact that the state isn't sharing the upstream costs, but that is a primary driver, yes.
But to arrive at that, we have to have this another company to be formed on AGDC to take it to get that advantage, correct?
Senator Bishop, through the Chair, that from the administration, that's my understanding, certainly, of their rationale for setting things up in that way. I'm not a tax attorney, so I can't comment on appropriate structures to ensure that benefit and how AGDC versus a separate subsidiary compare on that front, but that is certainly my understanding that that's why the administration has chosen that structure.
Thank you.
So, again, what you have fundamentally is, in particular, in lower price environments, relatively speaking, a greater share for the state of Alaska, certainly more than 25% share at almost any price range. And relatively speaking, in lower prices, more going to the state of Alaska and less going to the federal government. The one other caveat I'd put on this is to say the producer's chart shows lower value to the producers in the in-kind world versus the in-value world. That can change substantially based on the assumptions that one puts into the model. And I mean, the first one, for instance, is this is run at a 25% share. At a 20% share, that's very different. And based on other parameters in terms of development costs, production profile, a whole range of things, that can change. So don't read that as saying, oh, producers are worse off in the in-value world than the in-kind world, but simply the overall picture is meant to demonstrate what the exposure to different price levels is to the state in value versus in kind more than anything else. With that, I will hand back to my colleague, Nico Safos.
Nico Safos for the record, Analytica. Three more slides we want to talk about. And in a way, we've kind of gone from that world of what does this project look like and the numbers that I showed you and then the numbers that Janik showed you. And in some ways, if you go with the path laid out by the HOA, you start caring about similar things that oil companies care about. You care about the price of the commodity, and then you care about making sure that you produce that commodity at the lowest possible cost. Right. So you think about this. If we were to go back to, you know, slide 10, you don't have to go back, just remember, how do you derive the value, highest price, lowest cost? So I wanted to have just three slides to speak to those two components. Slide 14, how do you think about price? We talked already a little bit about JCC and why you don't have to care about it, JCC, and you can just focus on ANS and you'll just be just as well off. But there's one thing we wanted to underscore, which is that just because something is indexed to oil doesn't mean it's the same price. Okay. That indexation to oil merely defines a relationship between two commodities, but that relationship can be very different. Okay. So that's the statement. Let's look at some evidence. The graph below shows you Taiwan. We've picked on Taiwan because it's a country with few long-term suppliers. We started off doing this analysis for Japan, and by the 14th line, you couldn't really see anything anymore, so we gave that up. So what is this meant to show you? So Taiwan has fundamentally three long-term suppliers, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Qatar. And it buys gas from these suppliers on a long-term basis, and the price of that gas is linked to oil. Okay, so all three prices are linked to oil. Indonesia, there are two contracts, actually, one signed in the late 1980s, another one signed in the mid-1990s. You can see, actually, the slope is pretty high in the sense that a $10 or $20 increase in the price of oil generates a pretty significant increase in the price of gas. So this is, to go back to the comment on oil equivalency, this is close to oil equivalency, that the two things move in tandem. 1% equals 1%. Now, go to Qatar in the bottom. Qatar was signed in 2005, the long-term deal. That was a time where the market, the buyers had the bargaining power. They had options. So you were competing to sell. You weren't competing to buy. And so that relationship, even though it still is linked to oil, is very different. It's very different at its starting point, and it's also very different in its slope. So if you were to ask, oh, oil is at 120, what's the price of LNG to Taiwan? The answer is, well, for whom? For Indonesia, it's about $20. For the Qataris, it's about $7 or $8. Right? Just because something is linked to oil doesn't mean it's the same price. And then we go to Malaysia. So you start off with a red. This is the original contract that Malaysia LNG signed. And this was signed in the early 1990s. And you can see that relationship a little bit closer to Qatar. So at some point, the Malaysians, about 2008, they said, wait a minute, now oil is at 100, and we're only earning 6 or 7, whereas you're paying the Indonesians 19 and 20. We want to revise the deal. So they revised it, and they ended up with the blue. So what are the lessons to learn here as you think about this project? First, don't obsess over whether it's just linked to oil. That is an important question, but that is not the final question. The question is, how is it linked to oil? The second thing is, new contracts don't impact existing deals. So just because Malaysia was able to revise its contract, or just because Indonesia had a better deal because they were selling higher, didn't really do much for Qatar. Right? So these deals are independent of one another. You have a deal, you'll sign a deal, you'll know what the price relationship is. If someone else 6 months later goes and signs another deal with the same consumer, same customer, doesn't matter for you. Your deal is intact. Having said that, there is a reality, which is that because you're doing a deal for a very long period of time, chances are you're going to get the future wrong, because that's what futures are for. And so all contracts have provisions to revisit things. So that's how Malaysia was able to go from red to blue. Right. Now, when you write a contract, you want to be smart, and your lawyers are going to help you with that, is that the review clause can be willy-nilly, right? You can't just say, you know, at any time you can review any clause, because then you might as well not have a contract. What's the point if you can review every clause at any point? The standard practice is there is a price review every 3 or 4 years that is allowed by the contract, and there is also a one-time sort of option to revisit things if outside of that cycle if things get completely out of hand. And there are ways in which that review clause can be restricted. So you can say, yes, we agree to review clause, but you can only change the price by 10% or 20%. So again, you can't, if you sign a contract with too much flexibility or too many things that can change, it's not worth anything. If you sign a contract that's too rigid, it's likely to be overtaken by events. So the point is trying to find a balance between those two things.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Machiki.
Just a question. So, okay, think about what could trigger a review clause, and think about like 2007. LNG goes from 750 million BTU to $16.
Yeah.
Okay, when after the earthquake, right? So things change. The price of shipping goes up as well. Mm-hmm. So does the entire supply, is the reasons that could trigger review clause price only, or is it across the entire, all of the factors across the supply chain that could impact the contract?
Through the chair, Nico Safos for the record. That is an excellent question. Let me step back a little bit and say what is a price review? What is the purpose of a price review? And it's really meant to do two things. It's usually exercised for two reasons for the most part. The first one is actually, if I can take you to the next slide, on volatility protection. That bottom chart has created a lot of arguments and price review clauses. So let me walk through it and then talk about why people may be upset with that. So the idea here is that a project, in particular a project that's concerned about whether it's going to be in the money, can find commercial ways to protect itself. The most typical is what is called an S-curve because of what the chart in the middle looks like, which it looks a little bit like an S. And what it means is that if you don't have an S-curve, you're kind of like Indonesia. The price of oil goes up, the price of gas goes up. S-curve says, you know what? I am concerned that the price of oil may go down and I might not make a good return on my investment. So I would like to slow down how that relationship plays out as prices go down. So I'd like some insurance. In the extreme case, you can go to the far right, which is really a floor, to say, look, I mean, you're looking at these charts from the administration's consultants. You're looking at, you know, maybe $12 break even. You can say, look, I want to earn $12. I do not care what the price of oil is. I want to make sure that I get my $12. You can probably sign a contract like that as long as you're willing to also give up on the upside.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So how does price review come into that? These contracts, this structure of the contract, was really driven by volatility in the price of oil of a temporary nature. What do I mean by that? I mean Gulf War. Gulf War happens, price of oil goes up. 3 months later, 6 months later, price of oil goes down. So you put an S-curve that says, okay, if that happens, let's not cause too much variation in the LNG price. And so that's the world in which these S-curves were designed. And so what happened in 2006-07, and one of the reasons Malaysia was upset and others, was those trigger points where it turns from a line to an S, those were like, you know, $25, $30. So because you wrote the contract in the 1990s, and you were thinking, oh, my God, what if oil goes to 25? Oh, it's not going to go. Don't worry. Oh, maybe it will. Let's put a little bit of an S-curve there, right? So the point is that you didn't really design the contract to survive in the world that you lived in, right? And so one of the big pieces of price revision was really getting rid of these floors and ceilings, because, I mean, if you have an LNG contract that is capped at $35 a barrel and the oil world is at 100, it's not just that you're missing out, it's that the world that you live in is no longer fundamentally represented in the contract. And that's what allows you to make a fundamental price review. You can't just say, oh, so today if you were to sign a contract, if oil were to go to 110, you can't raise your hand and say, oh, price review, because it's not unreasonable for the price of oil to go to 110. If it goes to 250 or to 10, you can raise your hand and say, okay, price review, something is going wrong here. So a big part of price review is triggered by these clauses. A second cause for price review is triggered by the distribution of value between different participants. What does that mean? And we have some of these slides in our natural gas fundamentals presentation to LBNA a few weeks ago, and they're on the website. And what this basically says is, let's say, and let me give you the example of Equatorial Guinea, and I know we pick on them, unfortunately, but they're just such a good example. So Equatorial Guinea, when it was developing its project, it thought that the LNG was going to go to the United States. So it said, I want a net back relative to the United States. So just like everyone else who got the U.S. wrong, they got the U.S. wrong. So Equatorial Guinea sells the gas at the port at a price that's linked to the United States. So when the price in the United States tanks, their sales price tanks. Now, that LNG is taken by someone at the port, put on their ships, and sold to Japan for $17. So it leaves the port at 2, ends up at 17. And so what happens is when that structure takes place, the company that says, I was selling to you for Henry Hub, can say, okay, the world has changed because I thought it was going to go to the U.S. and we have to review. In fact, the company actually has not done that, the company that's selling, but the sovereign is not quite happy because they're taxing the LNG at 2%. And there was a good story about this in the Wall Street Journal a few months ago, and I didn't know that. I read it in the journal that said, actually, BG, which is the company that buys the gas and sells Japan, actually is making some voluntary payments to the government of Equatorial Guinea, right? Because the point is that you can upset governments only so much. And so if the government feels it's getting a really rotten deal, you face a much bigger challenge. Other place where this has happened is Trinidad. They had a deal where they thought they weren't sharing the upside, so they fought to change the terms. Yemen just recently concluded deals to basically strike out S-curves because they signed contracts in 2006, 2007 that assumed a much lower oil price world. So usually it's a lot more time sovereigns that try to restructure this. Because if you're an oil company and you actually buy the gas from Yemen at 5, you can still sell it to Korea for 20 because you care about the 20, but you only get taxed on the 5, right? And so that's what creates tension. So the oil company, if they're along the chain, doesn't really matter to them where that value is distributed. Sorry, it was a slightly long-winded, but I think it's important to understand the types of risks that you're getting into. So the bottom line of this is what you should really care about is when there's a deal in front of you for selling gas, what is that price? What kind of exposure does it give you? And are there ways to protect yourself on the downside, and usually you can do that by foregoing some of the upside. Okay, so that's really the key thing on the price. And the other part that's on the price critical is timing matters. When you sign a deal matters. If the buyers have the power, you won't get as good of a deal than when the sellers have the power, and that's pretty self-evident. But the reason I want to underscore it is because that relationship ties you in. Right. So Qatar is still living in the bargaining power of 2005 and that contract that they signed there, not the bargaining power of 2014. Last slide, slide 16.
Thank you.
If you then step back and you ask, okay, now I have my producer hat on or my investor hat on, I'm an investor in this project, you care about the price and you get about the cost. So we've talked about price. Let's talk a little bit about cost. And this is really meant to answer the question, what could go wrong, right? Because in the current world, you are on the hook for 25% of the liquefaction, and you're on the hook for a share of the 25% potentially of the midstream, depending on how the TransCanada deal works through the GDP and the pipeline. So what you really care about is 25% of what? So right now you have a pretty broad range. It could be 45, it could be 65. That's a little bit too broad of a range. $20 billion starts to add up. And so as you move towards final investment decision, you're going to narrow that down because no oil company is going to make an investment without knowing whether it's going to be 45 or 65. There'll be a range, but it won't be that big. And so what we've tried to show you here is these are big, complicated projects that take a long time to put together. And, yes, sometimes they come online on time and under budget, but they usually don't, not recently at least. And so this is meant to show you a little bit about what kind of cost escalation has happened to other projects. Now, some of these the drivers for these costs are numerous. Some of them are global. steel is more expensive because China is consuming so much steel, right? So what can you do about that? You can't really do much about that. Some of them are country-specific. If you're in Australia, you can make a very good living working on these projects. And so when the competition for labor is so intense, because there's a once-in-a-generation commodity boom in Australia, the only way to secure labor is to pay up. And so that's the second cause of project overruns, cost overruns. And the last could be a very specific project, a project-specific issue. Pluto had some accidents, some fire at one of their facilities. They had strikes that slowed down the development. Sakhalin in Russia had a number of challenges with the pipeline route and with the sovereign. Snøhvit in Norway, I believe if my eyeballing of the earth is correct, probably the northernmost LNG project in the world, had a number of challenges with the environment that it operated and some of the technical challenges of constructing the facility there. So there are global drivers, there's national drivers, but those are just project-specific drivers that things can just go wrong. And so that should give you a sense of what type of cost overruns is possible. We realize that it's not very helpful to say it could be anywhere from 0 to 120%, that's the world you're going to be living in. But the point is that it wouldn't be a shock to many people to have, you know, a 10 or 20% cost overrun in a project of this scale. And obviously, you know, the more you know about the cost, the more you can appreciate what 10% could mean, right? Because 10% of $45 billion is a very different number than 10% of $65 billion. Right? So you'll get a little bit more clarity as you move towards final investment decision. That's what we had for you today, and so happy to answer any questions.
Senator Machicki, question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chairs, if you'll bear with me for just a moment. So delays, cost, scheduling overruns, right? We see the whole gamut here. But we talked about, can't remember your definition of the future, but we talked about how things can change. Have you, in your experience, plotted out when, and I think of the timing of Pluto, you talked about the importance of contract timing on commodity price and value. Has there ever been a delay that has turned out to be extremely beneficial to those sanctioning the project?
Through the chair, Nikos Tsafos. I trying to go through the options. I think there are projects that have been delayed where the damage has been less than anticipated. But I can't think off the top of my head a place where the delay was actually beneficial in the sense that, I mean, you can think of, oh, the price of gas is higher, so I'm selling at a higher price than if I sold last year, if I'd come online last year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible in a duration of a project that this could turn out to be beneficial. But given the capital that you have tied up, I can't imagine someone rationally try to slow it down. There was a period of time in 2008 during the economic crisis, 2009, where demand sort of cratered. And so I would say at that time there were projects that were going ahead at 100% of construction, and they probably slowed down to 90, 95%. No reason to pay people overtime to complete a project to sell a commodity that no one is dying to get. So there are things like that that on the margin could make a difference. But you just have so much capital tied up when you've spent $30 or $40 billion, you really want the money to start coming in. And it's difficult to defend to your bosses that this project that's already delayed and overrun, no, this is actually for the good of the company. You also get some corporate pressure on that.
If I could very briefly add to that, for the record, Janik Meyer, Analytica. Senator Machicki, through the chair, I'd add to that solely that in that sense, there's a big difference between the delays we're tracking here, right, which are the delays that really count, which is what happens post-FID versus everything that happened before that time. I think we could probably think of no end of examples of projects that were delayed for one reason or another in terms of the FEED process and things that happened until FID, where that delay meant that when they actually came to be marketing gas and signing contracts, that actually they were signing that, putting together those deals in a good market. But at the FID point, you've done those deals, those are sorted, and that's when you start spending the real money. And when you have delays after that point, every year is another year of both of net present value lost on billions or tens of billions of dollars of capital with no revenue coming in.
Follow-up, Senator Machiki?
I might clarify. So you're saying the contracts have been executed, so every moment not selling gas as a delay after FID is a is a hit to the bottom line, essentially.
And Senator Machiki, through the chair, it may be that the contracts have been executed and they include a requirement to have gas and have gas to sell, in which case that particularly
mm-hmm.
hurts. But even if they don't, it's you're not if market conditions improve post FID, you're not benefited from that particularly. And as far as you're not going to be signing new contracts at a better oil price slope. So you're not getting the benefit of that, but you are getting the downside of another year's delay, another year's interest on tens of billions of dollars with no revenue coming in and all the rest.
And if I could just add to that through the chair, Nico Salvas, what you said, Senator Chiki, on the foregone revenue, it actually might not even just be foregone. It might be negative, right? Because
mm-hmm.
there are cases where you're obligated to sell. Your project is not online. You have to go and buy cargoes to sell them. Or you may have to forego. There was a case of in Indonesia of the Tangguh project that had one of those S curves that were pretty low, and in fact one of the operators was shipping gas from Egypt that was previously fetching $17-$18, and it was selling it at $3-$4 because it had to meet some commitment. So there are things like that could drive the value of the delay. And that's why I said there are different degrees of how bad it is, but it generally tends to be bad to delay.
Senator Bishop, then Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd just like to, you know, I've looked at this pretty close, and I like building things, so I focus in on cost and cost overruns. And I just like to, just an observation, there's four projects here that came in on budget and with no overrun. But let's look at, you know, I'm looking at that. Why did that happen? Well, they're in the billion-dollar range. They're from $600 million to $1 billion projects, correct?
Yes, those are the projects.
Okay, so let's just hold that thought for a minute. So on budget, 0% cost overrun. And then let's go down here to, there's four projects at the bottom, 45% overrun down to 15.6. So, but the total cost of the projects, now you're in the $37 billion to $16 billion range. So now we're starting to get a sense, I'm starting to get a comfort zone of what a project might overrun when you start getting in that $40 billion range. So it's just an observation. And, Nikos, just to add value for our listeners here in Alaska, I really concur with what you're saying. You know, value equals highest price. You want to make sure you've got the lowest cost of construction because we want to get gas back to Alaskans at the cheapest molecule price at the burner tip. Thank you.
Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder, just while we have a minute, if you could talk about the risk to the state of having essentially one project to sell at one time. It's not as if, well, you know, when I look at this chart, there's three Australian projects. Obviously, Qatar has brought on many projects. Malaysia brings on many projects. Indonesia brings on many projects. We're gonna do this once, at least for the foreseeable future. And if we hit a sweet spot, that's great. But if we don't, we don't. I'm not Exxon. I don't have other, you know, prospects around the world. Maybe just describe how we can best protect ourselves against that. You know, the fact that we're just going to the market to establish long-term contracts for all of the gas we'll put through this pipeline for a 20-year period. In one, say, 12-month window.
Through the chair, Senator French, Nico Tsafis, for the record. That's an excellent question, Senator. Let me walk you through how I think about this. First of all, you'll know what kind of deals you get. Right? So you'll know at the time of final investment decision what kind of contracts you have at your hand. And insofar as those contracts are fairly similar between the different players, if you've timed the market wrongly, you just won't get to start building this project. Right? And this is the point that Janek was making before about the delays, which is that if you're out there marketing and you said, I have a break-even price of 11, 12, and no one seems to be giving me 11 or 12, then tough luck. Right? So that's one. So that's the very big picture, right, which is that in a way, if you think back to the timetable that the administration has put forward and to the analysis that we've told you, is that really you spend less than 10% of the total cost before a final investment decision. So it's still real money, but you haven't spent $45 or $65 billion unless you're sure that the deal is good. That's one. The second thing I would say is there are other ways to sort of approach that. This is the selling of gas of the project of this type is actually really a multi-year affair. You'll probably be marketing gas for about 2-3 years to sign all the contracts. So that's going to be crucial to see how that changes. The more important thing, though, is to appreciate that Alaska has one sort of asset, and I realize it may not seem like an asset to you, which is that it's going to take so long to put together this project, that, in fact, you're targeting a marketing window that no one is targeting. So if you look at all the – if you go to LNG 17, one of the big LNG conferences, and I was there in April and your administration was there, and you sort of look at people cutting deals. They're cutting deals for LNG in 2016, 17, 18, 19. No one is really trying to cut deals for LNG in 2022 or 23, 24. So in a way, you, because of how long it will take for this project to get going, you're targeting a slightly different window. And so you might benefit from the fact that for companies that are thinking strategically more long-term, you are tapping into a need that they have which other players aren't necessarily responding to. And I can tell you from experience, before coming to Juno, spending a lot of time in Washington, I had a number of conversations with some of my Japanese colleagues who are getting very excited about Alaska because they're thinking that Alaska is sort of the next tranche from what they're looking at. So this Alaska is after the lower 48, after maybe East Africa, after Western Canada. So in a way, you're sort of in your own window, and that could be quite beneficial. The last thing I would say to that is there is actually a possibility for you, depending on how you market this gas, to not it may not be just one big block. You have three trains. Usually these trains come online maybe 6 months between one another or 9 months. You may not sign up 100% of the gas at FID. You may sign up 70 or 80%. So you may still have some gas to play around with. There are other ways in which you can sort of get more comfortable. But the bottom line is if you are marketing gas, and the responses you're getting from the buyers are not good, don't worry, you're just not going to go forward. Like, you're not going to get to the point of spending the money, and so we're spending the sizable amount of money. That's usually what happens to LNG projects, is that they start, they have some price expectations. If those aren't realized, they just kind of slow down. Very few projects are just going to say, you know what, we'll just wing it. Let's throw $45 billion and see what happens. Companies haven't quite gone to that comfort level yet. And
thank you.
If I were on the board of any of them, I can understand why.
Senator Machicki.
Mr. Sofos, I appreciate the way you phrase things. And my understanding is that you don't necessarily have less risk because you have more projects. So the example for me is it's not like Australia – those projects averaged their risks because they had more projects. And My understanding also is those huge cost overruns were largely because of the amount of projects in a short time. Primarily, it was a labor cost overrun. Is that correct? Can you answer that question?
Through the chair, absolutely. And knowing that I'm sitting next to an Australian, I'll be cautious about what I say. You're absolutely right. A lot of it was Australia-specific. Actually, some of it had to do with the exchange rate between the Australian and the U.S. dollar because of the commodity boom. Companies, usually international companies, earn U.S. dollars, but they buy Australian dollars to pay labor, so changes in the exchange rate. There's definitely a world in the bottom that you can see. There's a little bit too much Australia, and even Papua New Guinea is highly influenced by what's happening in Australia. There's definitely an Australia premium here, and I think you're absolutely right that these types of you may not have the same type of cost overrun. The other thing is, if you think about your project and the cost 45 to 65, I mean, the 65 is the overrun, right? I mean, we just don't call it overrun because we don't have a starting point to compare it and call it an overrun. But that's effectively what it is. It's just an expensive project. And so part of what you've seen companies now, and you've definitely seen that in a couple of projects not on this list, is companies will come out and say that we think it's going to cost X, even though we think it's going to be a little bit less than X, because it's better to be under budget and get credit than say what we really think and get hammered for getting it wrong. So in that sense, that's what this range that you have in front of you represents as well. So my point is that you may have no cost overruns, but that doesn't mean you have a cheap project.
I had one more, if you don't mind.
Sure, Senator Machikian.
On a project like this, which would be, so think about Alaska's project. Is Alaska's royalty production tax model more advantageous, or is Australia's sort of individual contractual model, which would be more advantageous to the sovereign, looking at Alaska's project?
Senator Machikian, through the chair, there are any number of ways of setting up appropriate fiscal arrangements. Australia in some ways actually has a very similar system to Alaska, and as far as the core of the Australian system is a profit-based tax, as is Alaska. For offshore projects, there's no royalty. For onshore projects, there's a royalty, but it's credited back. It's a royalty to the state government that the federal government effectively credits back and goes away. Contractual arrangements apply to certainly LNG projects in places like Qatar, Indonesia, a range of places. It seems to me, and this is sort of reflected in some of what we were looking at previously, that there is one thing, though, that really stands out about Alaska that is not, by and large, replicated in a lot of other projects, which is the sheer size of the midstream rather than the upstream component, right? In most places, if Black and Veatch a few days ago we were talking about Gorgon as a great analogy for this project, and there are some ways in which that's true, right? But Gorgon is also a great example of somewhere where you have a very big, difficult, costly upstream deep water development that is a big portion of the value, along with absolutely, a pipeline and a liquefaction project. Whereas I can't think of many, if any, other examples of LNG projects where you get to a $45 to $60 billion range where almost all of that is in the midstream. And in that sense, a tax regime that's focused entirely on the upstream and value that's netted back to the upstream, it seems to me, is less likely to be of benefit than something, however it's structured, that focuses on getting value throughout the chain.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Well, and this is more just directed, Madam Chair. I think this has been so helpful because, at least for me, this particular series of presentations has convinced me and solidified my belief that we having alignment in the equity share for Alaska is right, and that that's our best move forward. And I appreciated Senator French's question with respect to sort of what happens if no one shows up and the fact that the market takes care of those things. So for me, I think the last area of risk is maybe more in this midstream area, and the fact of
where we're locked in places that Alaska may have some obligation. And there was a statement made that I thought was really interesting about how companies don't just sort of throw money at things. But we had something called a GIA here in our state that was an example of the company of Alaska acting a little bit like a company, locking ourselves into a $500 million proposition a little bit like that. And I just encourage us to remember that, that we did lock ourselves into that and we did force ourselves to pay forward in a series of installments. Now we've already paid $300 million, that's water under the bridge, but as we move forward into this part, I think any place where there's further inability to extricate ourselves in a place that isn't in alignment with fair business principles and market principles, I think we want to do that. And that was my concern always with the AGEA contract before, was that we were putting ourselves on a path that sort of seemed like it was out of alignment with basic economics and sort of a business deal. It was sort of forcing something. And I like this particular bill. I like what we've set ourselves up for because it does make sense. I like the alignment notion, putting ourselves in an equity place. But I think in that midstream area and where we're talking about the TransCanada portion, I like them as a partner. I just think we need to really scrutinize that area. And so I just look to you as our chairwoman for us to really be sure that, you know, we've got that part nailed down.
I appreciate that, Senator McGuire, and that's something I've asked the administration to make much clearer to us, where those off-ramps are, what the off-ramps cost us, the time frame of them, all of that.
Yeah.
So we will be hearing from the administration again and, of course, our consultants as well. All right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. That was a great presentation. Learned a lot. Good. Thank you. I'm going to ask committee members, I know you've been thinking about Senate Bill 138, what amendments would you make to this piece of legislation? I'm going to ask for amendments to be in my office by Tuesday at 9 a.m.
Okay.
So think about it over the weekend. It's a three-day weekend, so any amendments you would want to offer. Before we conclude today, we're going Yes, Senator French.
Can I just ask for one more day on that? It strikes me as being unreasonably short. We haven't even heard the end of the bill yet. The administration has not completed the overview of the bill. We haven't gotten to the end of it. It seems unreasonable to ask for amendments before we've heard the entire bill. I'd ask you to reconsider.
I'll take that into consideration. Thank you, Senator French. Before we conclude tonight, we're going to hear SJR 5, Offshore Oil and Gas Revenue. Senator Wielichowski is the sponsor of the bill. His staff, Michelle Seiderman, is going to be here to present the bill. So, Ms. Seiderman, welcome.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
just on McGuire. The previous thing, the last question that I asked you regarding the nature of the uncertainty surrounding those off-ramps, are we planning on having any kind of discussion on that on Tuesday or Wednesday? That would be the only area in which I would be looking for potential amendments.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Can I
pause for a moment? Yes, Senator Michiki.
If I can clarify with Senator McGuire, you mean in the MOU, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Welcome, Ms. Seiderman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Seiderman. I serve as staff to Senator Bill Wielichowski. He asked me to convey his regrets to you. He had commitments in Anchorage, and he probably has arrived there already. All of you are well aware of the vast oil and gas potential in the federal waters off our coasts. It's a huge area, more than a billion acres and more than 6,000 miles of coastline. This area is believed to contain the largest undiscovered energy resources in the United States, estimated at 27 billion barrels of oil and 132 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. And this is more than the current estimates for the Atlantic and Pacific regions of the OCS combined. The potential for development is obviously enormous, as is the potential benefit to the U.S. Treasury. A University of Alaska study some years back found that energy production off Alaska could generate 35,000 jobs on average annually within the state over a 50-year period. Many more jobs would be created outside. The total Alaska payroll would be estimated at something like $80 billion, so it's a huge, huge resource. Since statehood, we all know that the federal government has held numerous lease sales off our coast. It's collected more than $8 billion from these lease sales and associated activities, including annual rents. Unfortunately, Alaska has received little revenue from all of this, certainly less than $1 billion. This is in contrast to what happens when the federal government leases lands within our boundaries, our land boundaries. Everyone knows that in that case, host states receive 50% of the revenue. And that's done to compensate those states from any impacts they may bear as a result of that development. So this is an automatic process that occurs off budget at the federal level. And, of course, coastal states have been arguing for many years that the same should hold true for offshore development where, in fact, the costs and risks are oftentimes much greater. In 2006, the federal government recognized this inequity and gave four states a 37.5% share of revenues generated from offshore development. That unfortunately did not include Alaska. It included Mississippi, Texas, Louisiana, and Alabama. As the state with the greatest offshore oil and gas potential, it makes absolutely no sense for us to be left out of that kind of arrangement. Fortunately, the stars are coming closer into alignment in Washington, D.C. We have a new chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee this past week. That committee is now going to be led by Senator Mary Landrieu, who has been a huge advocate of OCS revenue sharing. She and our Senator Lisa Murkowski have joined forces. They've introduced a bill called Fixing America's Inequities with Revenue Act. It's called the FAIR Act. And the bill would provide all coastal states, including Alaska, with a fair share of revenues from both offshore oil and gas production and offshore alternative energy production. So it's a broader new approach. Unfortunately, the White House is opposing this act, and the primary reason is cost. And we are all well aware of the huge federal deficit, and something that we all take very seriously. Senator Murkowski, however, has called this concern over the deficit short-sighted in this case because revenue sharing will enable the states to support offshore development by investing in roads, ports, other facilities absolutely necessary, and to invest in the infrastructure that will enable that development to be safe and environmentally responsible. So her anticipation, and I think it's a fair anticipation, is that, in fact, providing some revenue sharing to the states will lead to more offshore development, which will lead to greater revenues for the federal government. So a focus on dividing a pie that's one size right now really may not be appropriate. We have developed a CS for the resolution in front of you. We did so after consulting with Mr. Adrian Herrera, who is the director of Arctic Power. I'm sure you're all familiar with Mr. Herrera. He should be online right now. And what he did is walked us through the main concerns the White House had with this bill. And so we added something like six new whereases to this resolution to respond very directly to the administration's concerns. And I'm not sure that today you have time to get into that CS, but it is prepared, and Mr. Herrera can speak to how he sees that. He did give us two other pieces of advice. One is that action fairly soon would be helpful because Senator Landrieu will be pushing this in the near term, and he should really speak to that. He also said that in this particular case, having a resolution sponsored by a Democratic member of the state legislature could be handy because we're, of course, trying to convince a Democratic administration. So with that, I'll just close and say that OCS development offers many benefits from the state in times of tight budgets, economic diversification needs, and job creation. So we all stand to gain from it.
Very good. Questions from Ms. Seiderman? Okay, seeing none, I do know that Adrian Herrera is online. So at this time, I'll open public testimony. Adrian, are you there?
Yes, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead and
identify
yourself and proceed.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Just for the record, my name is Adrian Herrera. I'm the DC coordinator for Arctic Power. Arctic Power is a 501c6 not-for-profit organization based in Alaska, and we're sole purpose to argue for the environmentally responsible development of the federal lands in Alaska's Arctic, both on and offshore. And as Ms. Seiderman stated, we really greatly support this resolution and the whole notion of revenue sharing for the state of Alaska. Rather than reiterate what she said, I'd just like to say that the resolution has to be very, very specific towards the concerns of the White House as addressed by the Congressional Budget Office Secretary during the hearing for the FAIR Act last year. Senator Ranking Member Murkowski and the new chairwoman, Landrieu, are very much considering this their baby, and we expect it to move this year. It has a very, very good chance, considering the two senior members of the committee are both the authors of the bill. It is supported as a co-sponsor by Senator Begich, who, by the way, also has his own revenue-sharing bill, S-199. Now, the S-199 bill is a good bill. It's supported by a majority, I would say, but the problem with it is it's regional-specific. It's only for Alaska, and it gives a much more detailed revenue stream to the coastal village infrastructure and the native community, the tribal infrastructure up there, than the FAIR Act does. Other than that, it's the numbers are the same, the 37.5%. But with that regard, back again to the FAIR Act. The FAIR Act has had one hearing last year in July. We expect it would have to have another hearing. They have not come up with $6 billion, which the Congressional Budget Office scored the bill as for pay for. That's $6 billion spent over 10 years. But again, it's the specific arguments of the White House, which has to do with the reduction of funds going to the National Treasury. When you take away 37.5%, they deem that as almost robbing the National Treasury of its rightful funds. But also the second one, important point is the president's emphasis on environmental conservation funds, in specific the Land and Water Conservation Fund, LWCF, and other environmental projects nationwide. And his argument is that he would like to use offshore revenues to recycle those to fund LWCF nationwide and also other environmental projects. And he regards the FAIR Act as stripping that away, or at least reducing that, not stripping that. But in reality, it's not. As Senator Landrieu and Murkowski have both said, we have no intention whatsoever of taking a penny away from LWCF. Regardless, this LWCF is one of his most sticking points against this. And for us to succeed with the Senate Joint Resolution 5, it has to address this concern. Luckily, I think, to be honest with you, looking at it from a 60,000-foot view, I think that both sides can be aligned. It just is a case of us providing a rebuttal to the White House's arguments against this to say, hey, we're not against you on this. We understand your concerns, and we can work with you on this and fund LWCF and fund your environmental projects and arrange the funding to states so that your projects, your environmental projects, are mitigated against. That money isn't taken away. And just so the committee knows, the 37.5% is made up of two sectors. 27.5% goes to the state coffers, so it would go straight to the state of Alaska. And then the state of Alaska would have to apply to the Treasury for an additional 10%, which could only be spent on alternative energy development or coastal or environmental mitigation. And until the Treasury is satisfied of the project submitted for money, the state wouldn't be awarded part of that 10%. At any rate, the 10%, remember, is not just 10% of the state's share. It's 10% of the entire pie. And this 10% is going for projects that are exactly the same as what the Land and Water Conservation Fund and the President's other environmental projects do anyway. And as Mary Landrieu, the new chairwoman, has stated, that these projects are things that will be much better mitigated by the state on a state level than from the Treasury or the Department of Interior on a national level. States are much more efficient at environmental mitigation and spending money appropriately in this regard, with regard to OCS development, than national DOI level agencies are. With that, I'll just open it up for questions.
Does anyone have questions for Mr. Herrera? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room or on the phone that would like to testify on this resolution? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. Ms. Seiderman, I appreciate the work you've done on this resolution. I know you've updated it. It was actually introduced last year, and we've gotten a complete bill packet now, so thank you for that. I actually have a couple amendments, too, I'd like to offer to it, so we'll work on a committee substitute. So at this time, I'll just hold the bill. We'll hear it again very soon, because I understand the imminent nature of that D.C. legislation. Good. So, yes, Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And if I could just, through the chair, say on the record as well, I'd love it if you'd come by my office or I'll come by yours. Similarly, I just want to say on the record, I'm taking deep breaths as I'm listening to the testimony, because I get so frustrated about the way we're viewed by our federal government. It's just the work that we've done, Senator Giesel, also on our Alaska Arctic Policy Commission, you know, it's about our people. And I would love to see a few more whereases in here about what we have done as a state already, using the minimal amount of money that we do have within our state to do things like relocate villages, to prevent coastal erosion, to fund our Arctic University in Fairbanks, to help look at affordable housing in villages, to look at coastal ports, the funding for deep water ports, all kinds of things. And so I think one of the things that I think is important, in addition to just sort of appeasing the federal government, is to educate them about what we would do with these funds and what we're already doing, in the sense that as a sovereign, we haven't waited around. We've been for 20 years asking for a polar class icebreaker. We haven't gotten one. We've been asking for help in terms of you know, the Arctic and development, and Alaska has dug into our own coffers to do this, and it would really be nice to have some additional revenue sharing in the way that our other Gulf Coast states have had to put toward these efforts. And I think a few whereases that could talk about the needs. We've identified over $250 billion worth of infrastructure needs that are out there for the people of Alaska. And it's, you know, and it comes down to things like 200,000 cruise ship passengers that are making their way through, the potential for oil spills that are occurring in the Bering Sea. You have almost a billion tons worth of pollock that feed the earth, and the potential for disaster. There are things that I just don't know that people are aware of out there that I think it'd be nice to beef this up. You kind of see the same whereases over and over. And I'd just like to see us start bringing life. Where will those dollars go, instead of it just being sort of, well, we want to use it for environmental causes? Well, we do too, and we're environmentalists, and we are some of the best, because we're lifelong Alaskans, and we want to live here forever, and we want our waters to be clean, and we want the people who have lived here for tens of thousands of years to be able to continue to live in their villages.
Excellent comment, Senator McGuire. So, work to do on this. Great. Thank you, Ms. Seiderman, for presenting that. Our next meeting is Wednesday, February 19th. We'll continue our consideration of Senate Bill 138. Beginning at 5:30 that evening, we'll take public testimony. Members of the public can testify through their local LIOs. So at this time, I will adjourn the meeting. The time is 5:06 p.m.